Britain goes to the voting booth.
I think we're expecting not just a Labour victory, but a Labour victory on quite a large scale.
Hurricane Beryl hits Jamaica.
I just have to pray that all the people of Jamaica is safe.
And the evolution of Barbie as she celebrates her 65th birthday.
It's a perfect time for this exhibition, actually. Barbie's resonance in culture has never been larger, more prominent. We had a cultural phenomenon after the release of the film. It's very gratifying to see Barbie explored in this way.
Today is Thursday, July 4th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Scott Walterman.
I am delighted to have the support and the backing of The Sun.
The Rupert Murdoch-owned British tabloid newspaper The Sun endorsed the Labour Party and its leader, Keir Starmer, on Wednesday.
I think that shows just how much this is a changed Labour Party back in the service of working people.
On Thursday, voters in the United Kingdom cast ballots in a national election, passing judgment on British Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's 20 months in office and the four Conservative prime ministers before him. Voters are widely expected to do something they haven't done since 2005, elect a Labour Party government. During the final days of campaigning, Sunak insisted the outcome was not a foregone conclusion.
Just 130,000 people could change the outcome of this election. That's what the latest analysis shows.
So let's find out more about what to expect. Joining us now to talk about it is Professor Laura Beers with the School of International Service at American University. So what are we expecting, big picture, from the election?
I think we're expecting not just a Labour victory, but a Labour victory on quite a large scale. There has been speculation about the full extent of the Conservative collapse, and I think wildly overstated suggestions that perhaps the Conservatives could finish tomorrow night not even the largest party or second largest party in Parliament. But what seems to be increasingly clear is that Labour are going to win and win big.
It's been a long time, right, since Labour had a government?
Yes, it's been 14 years, so not since 2010. And you had first a Conservative-dominated coalition government and then a straight Tory government for the past 14 years.
What do you think is driving the flip?
I think there are a couple of factors at play. I mean, I think that the size of the Labour majority is going to be helped by the same, push towards the hard right that we've seen across Europe for the past couple of years, in that the Reform Party, which is the alternative to the right of the Conservatives, I think is going to scoop up some of the vote that would otherwise go to them. But I think the dynamic that's different than in other European countries is that there's a significant backlash against the Conservative policies of austerity, which has really bled public sector services and led to an underinvestment in infrastructure in ways that people are feeling on the ground. Their lived experience is one of a country increasingly starved for needed resources. And so there's a backlash against that.
If Labour wins as big as we think they are, how does that change Great Britain as a player on the world stage? Can we expect a policy shift that we'll feel?
I think in terms of foreign policy, the Labour Party has effectively committed to much the same policy in terms of support for Ukraine and also support for Israel that the Conservatives were pursuing on the foreign stage. I think the biggest difference is likely to be in terms of relations with the European Union. There's really virtually no chance of revisiting the question of Brexit and of having a second referendum. I don't think anyone in the Labour Party is talking about that now. But I think there probably will be a movement towards rapprochement in terms of trade and in terms of other kind of bilateral agreements between Britain and the European Union, bringing them back into closer collaboration.
Professor Laura Beers with the School of International Service at American University. In our continuing coverage of the 2024 U.S. presidential election, the first debate of the 2024 season is in the history books, but the question, 1 week later, is whether President Joe Biden will remain in the race after a terribly weak performance that has raised questions within his own party. Questions about his age and mental fitness to lead. His opponent, Donald Trump, keeping a low profile and the focus on Biden's shaky performance. VOA senior Washington correspondent Carolyn Pursuti takes a look at these developments.
The optics? Two elderly men sniping at each other in the first presidential debate. The overwhelming impression is that President Joe Biden, at 81, stumbled, and at times was difficult to understand or follow. At one point, Biden said, "I'm going to continue to move until we get the total ban on the total initiative relative to what we're going to do with more border patrol and more asylum officers." At which point Trump responded, "I really don't know what he said at the end of that sentence. I don't think he knows what he said either." Now U.S. Representative Lloyd Doggett of Texas is the first Democrat to state publicly that Biden should withdraw from the race. Analysts say that changes the dynamic. Thomas Schwartz, a political historian at Vanderbilt University, spoke on Zoom.
If I had to gamble now, I'd say it's 50-50 more than anything that Biden will not be on the ticket.
Not if the president has anything to do with it. He admits to aging, but points to his competitors' false debate claims.
"I don't speak as smoothly as I used to. I don't debate as well as I used to. But I know what I do know. I know how to tell the truth."
However, a CNN poll shows 3 out of 4 voters say Democrats have a better chance of winning the presidency without Biden as the party's nominee. Historically, losing the first debate doesn't necessarily doom a presidency.
But what it did do is to...
In 2012, analysts say then-President Barack Obama had a weak debate performance. But then he went on to win re-election. Again, Schwartz.
"The reason for the bad first debate was in Obama's case, he just wasn't as prepared. But he the next debate came up fairly quickly, and he did very well in that. Not exactly the same thing."
In another poor debate performance.
"Pays for pay and salary, or pay and pension."
President Ronald Reagan appeared confused at age 73. John Fournier is with the American Enterprise Institute.
Was really at the first debate thought of as not performing well for his age, and came back and had a good second debate. So there's a short-term strategy to shore up the base, and a longer-term strategy to really show that this was an aberration and that he is able to act more vigorously and more presidential.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump is trying to keep the focus on last week's debate.
"Joe Biden spent the entire week at Camp David resting, working, studying. He studied very hard. He studied so hard that he didn't know what the hell he was doing."
Analysts say whether President Biden steps aside depends on his support in the Democratic Party and whether there are more public calls for him to resign from the race. Carolyn Pursuti, VOA News.
Donald Trump has established a sizable lead over Biden in the White House race since the two candidates debated last week, according to separate opinion polls published on Wednesday by the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. We're following these other stories from around the world. 25 soldiers accused of fleeing the enemy while fighting M23 rebels in the Democratic Republic of Congo were sentenced to death Wednesday during a one-day trial. Hamas said on Wednesday its leader, Ismail Haniyeh, conducted calls with Qatari and Egyptian mediators about ideas to reach a deal to end the war in Gaza. A settlement tracking group says Israel has approved the largest seizure of land in the occupied West Bank in more than 30 years. Peace Now said Wednesday that authorities recently approved the appropriation of 12.7 square kilometers of land in the Jordan Valley. Turkey's bid to join the BRICS trading group, a likely topic of discussion between Turkish President Erdogan and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin on the sidelines of the two-day Shanghai Cooperation Organization Summit in Kazakhstan on Wednesday. As Dorian Jones reports from Istanbul, the bid was Erdogan playing a delicate balancing act in his relations with both Washington and Moscow.
Atilla Yeşilada is a Turkey analyst for Global Source Partners, a political analyst firm.
The idea of a new platform which would develop mutual trade between countries that are geographically separated inherently appeals to Turkey and fits in with foreign policy. And I think it was a message to Putin that Turkey has no intention to either downgrade or abandon the ever-growing or closer commercial relations with Russia.
Putin has close ties with Erdogan, but has warned Turkey over its recent rapprochement efforts with its traditional Western allies. Putin is a strong proponent of Turkey's bid to join BRICS. Analysts say the move is also part of Moscow's strategy to counterbalance Beijing's efforts to dominate the trading group. Ceren Erginç is a China specialist at the Center for European Policy Studies.
BRICS as like the back, China's backyards, because all the countries that the membership invitation was extended were the countries that China wanted to have better relations and China wanted to see in BRICS, which in a way bypassed Russia and India as the other major powers within BRICS big time.
Turkey's bid to join BRICS comes as its decades-long effort to become part of the European Union remains stuck over human rights concerns. The impasse is hurting Turkey's ability to trade, prompting Erdogan to look elsewhere. Atilla Yeşilada is a Turkey analyst for Global Source Partners.
What played a role is that he was extremely angry at EU for not advancing Turkey's accession bid and not even giving Turkey a date to update the customs union. It really fits in with Turkey's overall policy goals, which are not only promoted by Erdogan, but widely endorsed with Turkish policy establishment of not being beholden to any political bloc, either West or the East.
Erdogan is due to attend the NATO summit next week in Washington, where he's expected to reaffirm his security commitments to the West. But analysts say Turkey's bid to join BRICS will be an uncomfortable reminder that Ankara is at the same time looking beyond its traditional Western allies to achieve its goals. Dorian Jones, VOA News, Istanbul.
Hurricane Beryl sideswiped Jamaica on Wednesday, and while we won't know the full extent of the damage until a proper survey can be made, we did get an early indication from the island. Here's the director of the U.S. National Hurricane Service, Michael Brennan, in Miami.
We're seeing some ham radio reports of damage, wind damage occurring, storm surge occurring in this onshore flow here where we're seeing these southerly and southeasterly winds into the southern coast of Jamaica. We're expecting to see storm surge of 6 to 9 feet above normal tide levels with dangerous breaking waves and damaging wave action on top of that.
The Cayman Islands have also been hit. Same situation. We won't know how bad it is until they can get out and get a look around. The storm is still moving westward. We expect it will threaten others. Once again, here's U.S. Hurricane Center Director Michael Brennan.
Beryl is expected to weaken as it moves overland to a tropical storm, but then expected to re-intensify and be at or near hurricane strength as we go from Saturday into Sunday and Monday as it slows and begins to turn more northwestward, bringing the center of the system close to northeastern Mexico or deep south Texas.
The strength of the hurricane has been fed by warmer oceans due to climate change. Another climate problem made worse by the changing climate is wildfires. In the United States, the Federal Forest Service has a new weapon in its arsenal for the 2024 wildfire season. Three new aircraft provided by Montana-based Neptune Aviation Services. Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn says the aircraft help ensure aerial capabilities year-round, especially during the heart of wildfire season.
Each plane can load 3,000 gallons of water or fire retardant in as little as 6 minutes. It also doesn't require ground support, making them highly independent.
And the safety factors, the capability of this aircraft, and the tank technology is so much better. So we provide a much better product to the ground guy in a much safer fashion.
According to the USFS, wildland fire activity is occurring earlier in the spring and lasting longer into the fall. The fires are also more intense, making it harder to control in remote areas of the country. Alex Robertson is the USFS Acting Director of Fire and Aviation Management.
The really high value resources that we have, which are generally the hotshot crews, the aircraft, air tankers, of course, Type 1 helicopters, we run out of those things once we start getting busy. There's just not enough of that stuff to meet 100% of everybody's needs.
Neptune pilot Ryan Baer says past seasons have been like a roller coaster.
There's days where you catch a small fire or you protect a house or you get a crew out of a tough spot and man, you just feel on top of the world. And then there's other days like I'll use the Mendocino complex when all of California's on fire. You're looking at 26-mile fire line and this is your 15th day of just drawing a line and then it gets burnt over and the next day you do it again. That can be soul crushing.
Reuters correspondent Christy Kilburn. More bad weather to report, this time in China, where people in the Hunan province woke up to devastating losses on Wednesday after heavy rains and floods pounded the area. Here's Reuters correspondent Veta Chan.
This shop owner in southern China's Hunan province is busy cleaning up debris on Wednesday after heavy rainfall and flooding devastated her stationery store. She says she didn't receive any notice to move her goods and ask, how can a family survive in this situation? Heavy rainfall pounded parts of Hunan earlier this week, causing the water level of a local river to reach its highest level in 70 years. Local authorities have activated the maximum emergency response level. This restaurant owner said she had to flee before it became impossible to get herself out. Now, with her business flooded, she says she is heartbroken and doesn't know how she will provide for her children. Last week, President Xi Jinping urged authorities to put in all-out efforts to protect lives as floods and natural disasters increased. China has provided more than $316.4 million in funds to help with rescue efforts and emergency supplies, as deadly floods and landslides caused by almost 2 weeks of torrential rain ravaged several parts of the country. In Changsha, the capital of Hunan, the Xiang and Laodao rivers are expected to hit peak dangerous levels Thursday morning, state media reported.
That's Reuters correspondent Veta Chan. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Scott Walterman.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America.
In the United States, July 4th is Independence Day. It's an annual celebration of nationhood, commemorating the passage of the Declaration of Independence by the Continental Congress on July 4th, 1776. This Independence Day, 2024, has special meaning for hundreds of newly sworn-in U.S. citizens.
I feel like I'm free, you know, pretty much. Even though I was free when I got here, but now I feel like, okay, I feel like freedom.
Close to 190 naturalization ceremonies, that's where these immigrants get sworn in as U.S. citizens, are set to take place this week as the country celebrates its 248th birthday. And finally,
hi Barbie.
Hi Barbie.
Hi Barbie.
Hi Barbie.
A new exhibition looking at the evolution of Barbie opens in London this week as the famed Mattel doll celebrates her 65th birthday this year.
It's a perfect time for this exhibition, actually. Barbie's resonance in culture has never been larger, more prominent.
That's Kim Colmon, the Senior Vice President of Design for Mattel.
So we had a cultural phenomenon after the release of the film. It's very gratifying to see Barbie explored in this way. No one has ever put on an exhibition that quite goes into the detail around the design process and the design thinking that goes into the brand.
An example?
The hidden history of Barbie Pink. And today we all associate the doll brand with that color. This entire exhibition is pink, as you can see. But that history is a much more recent one, I think, than a lot of people realize. The brand really only associates itself with pink from the early 1980s onwards. And that means pink packaging, pink branding, the dolls' clothes and accessories and houses all turn pink. And that, if you think about it, it's one of the most successful brand marketing campaigns ever. You think Barbie, you think pink.
That's the curator of Barbie, the exhibition, Danielle Tom. And she says it's not just about clothes and color.
Of course, the original Barbie was exclusively imagined as a thin white woman. And over the years, Mattel, I think, have taken steps to rectify that initially quite narrow definition of what female beauty is. So I think that in today's world, they are definitely doing a significantly improved job of producing dolls and presenting those dolls to the public in a way that children who play with Barbie, whoever they are, wherever they're from, can see something of themselves in the doll.
Barbie, the exhibition, running at the Design Museum from July 5th to February 23rd, features more than 250 items from the Barbie universe, including an array of dolls showing her changing appearance, design sketches, and dream houses. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thank you so much for being with us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Scott Walterman.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
The upcoming NATO summit in Washington, July 9th to July 11th, will celebrate 75 years of the most successful defensive alliance in history. The agenda will focus on current challenges and will set the course to confront challenges of the future. During a recent interview, Secretary of State Antony Blinken underscored the importance of recalling what lies at the heart of NATO's foundation.
And that's the power of collective defense, the power of Article 5. That says an attack on one is an attack on all, is the strongest possible deterrent to aggression, the strongest and most effective way to prevent war in the first place, to avoid conflict in the first place, because any would-be aggressor knows that an attack on any one member means they're going to have to deal with every member of the alliance.
The number of countries that are now NATO members is 32, with Finland and Sweden being the most recent, something Secretary Blinken said that for most people would have been unimaginable just a few years ago.
We have an alliance that's stronger and has greater investment in it than it's ever had. We now have 23 countries that are meeting the 2% of GDP committed to defense mark that was set at the Wales Summit back in 2014. There were just 9 countries in 2021 that met the mark. We're now at 23. An 18% increase in defense investment by the allies across the alliance.
Another aspect of a strengthening alliance is the partnership with countries beyond North America and Europe.
We have 4 partners from the Indo-Pacific coming to the NATO summit, as they have for the last 3 years: Australia, New Zealand, Japan, Korea. This is one manifestation and one recognition of something that really is new, which is that increasingly partners in Europe see challenges halfway around the world in Asia as being relevant to them, just as partners in Asia see challenges halfway around the world in Europe as being relevant to them. Prime Minister Kishida put it best in the wake of the Russian aggression against Ukraine. He said, what happens in Europe today could happen in Asia tomorrow.
The NATO summit in Washington will, as Secretary Blinken said, make sure that we have the right defenses across the alliance where they're needed. It's manifestly in the interests of the people that all of us represent.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.